Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with today's arguments before the Supreme Court on the Defence of Marriage Act, DOMA, and speak with Tobias Wolff, a professor at the University of Pennsylvania Law School who has participated in some of the highest profile gay rights cases of the last several years. We'll discuss the apparent split between the justices on overturning DOMA because it violates equal protection under the 14th Amendment and assess whether they will kick the can down the road rather than make a bold ruling. Then we'll examine the very real possibility of war or some kind of military action breaking out on the Korean Peninsula following North Korea's escalating threats and the cutoff of the hotline with South Korea. Sumi Terry, the former director of Japan, Korea, and Oceanic Affairs at the National Security Council, joins us to discuss the extent to which the North has dug itself into a rhetorical trap where they have to deliver on their threats and the possibility that this time the South will not roll with the punches. Then finally, we'll speak with Michael Lind, the author of Land of Promise, An Economic History of the United States, about the real nature of American capitalism that is no longer about creating wealth, but extracting it in a new form of rentier capitalism that rewards the real takers, as opposed to industrial capitalism of old that was about makers. Michael Lind offers his arguments in a series of articles at Salon.com. Private Interest Parasites, How Rich Mooches Hurt America, and Defeating Useless Rich People. Joining us now is Tobias Wolff, who's a professor at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. His research includes the fields of civil procedure and constitutional law, and his advocacy work has included participation in some of the highest profile gay rights cases of the last several years. He's one of the nation's leading authorities on the U.S. military's former Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy, and has written on discrimination by the Boy Scouts of America, and has commented widely on marriage equality. Welcome to Background Briefing, Tobias Wolff.
Thank you, Ian. Thank you for having me back on the program.
And today, of course, the second day before the Supreme Court today was the Defense of Marriage Act, DOMA. Yesterday was Prop 8. Before we begin on DOMA, do you have any comments on what happened yesterday with Prop 8?
Well, I guess on both days, I would say that the court was clearly struggling a lot with the issues before it. There are some arguments before the court where, you know, while the justices are clearly exploring the issues, one gets a pretty powerful sense for where the consensus is on the court. And I would say it's difficult to discern consensus from either of these 2 days. In the Prop 8 argument, there are major questions about whether the case is properly in front of the court at all. There is this so-called standing issue, which sounds like a very technical issue, but is very important, which might result in the court deciding that it needs to dismiss the appeal. And an issue actually came up during argument over Prop 8 about whether the Supreme Court should have granted a writ of certiorari and taken the case from the Ninth Circuit at all. So in addition to the merits of the case, which of course is what most people think about when they talk about this lawsuit, there seems to be some questions that the court is struggling with about whether there's an appeal that they can hear at all.
So in terms of today's hearings, Tobias Wolff, DOMA, of course, the Defense of Marriage Act, was signed into law by President Bill Clinton in 1996, and it's been ruled unconstitutional by several lower courts that found it violates the Equal Protection Clause under the 14th Amendment. So it seems like the liberal judges on the court, not that they are liberal in the sense that the court has moved so far to the right that there are no Thurgood Marshalls and William O. Douglases anymore, but for the sake of our discussion, let's call them liberal judges, as the press does. They seem to be in favor of the 14th Amendment arguments that they should overturn it based on violating equal protection. But then the 10th Amendment was brought up, I think, by Justice Kennedy. So what's that argument, the 10th Amendment argument?
The DOMA case presents, as you say, a straightforward equal protection question, which is whether if Congress, as it has done in DOMA, singles out gay married couples and says, we'll exclude you from any federal favorable treatment for your marriage, even if a straight couple in the same circumstance would get all kinds of favorable treatment. That's the equal protection argument. The federalism argument, some might call it the 10th Amendment argument, has to do with the limited role of the federal government. You know, the federal government in the United States is very big, and it does a lot of very important things in our lives, and we're used to thinking of it as playing a very pervasive role, which in many ways it does. But it has always been a feature of our federal-state system of government that the federal government is authorized to set policy on certain matters, and they reach very broadly, but they're not unlimited. And one of the issues that I think there's pretty broad consensus is pretty much exclusively for the states to decide is the question of who's allowed to get married. Now, the states have to abide by other provisions of the Constitution, like equal protection, of course. But when it comes to just setting policy in the first place about who's allowed to get married, that's generally speaking the responsibility of the states. So one of the arguments that gets raised in the DOMA case is about the role of the federal government. Now, DOMA does not set policy about who's allowed to get married. But what DOMA does is to impose such dramatic burdens on married same-sex couples that some of the parties in this case have been arguing that it's interfering with the prerogatives of the states when it comes to setting their own marriage policies. And a related argument, once again, this is going to sound kind of technical, but it actually appeared to be very important in the arguments today. Whenever a government, whether it's the state government or the federal government, passes a law, they have to have some explanation for what their interest is in passing the law, right? What is the legitimate reason that the government has for enacting this law? And normally that's very easy. There's all kinds of purposes that government is allowed to promote with legislation. But one of the questions that was discussed a lot during argument today was what exactly is the federal government's interest in singling out one category of married couples and setting what's in essence a federal policy that says that you all are going to be treated in a disfavored way even if you're allowed to get married under state law. And that question of the kind of combination, if you will, of the federalism component of the case and the equal protection component of the case, it's something that the Solicitor General, Don Verrilli, spent some time talking about during his argument. And that whole cluster of issues seems to be very interesting to the members of the court.
And again, I'm speaking with Tobias Wolff, who's a professor at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. His research includes the fields of civil procedure and constitutional law, and his advocacy work has included participation in some of the highest profile gay rights cases of the last several years. He's one of the nation's leading authorities on the U.S. military's former Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy, and has written on discrimination by the Boy Scouts of America and has commented widely on marriage equality. Now, the case, of course, was brought by Edith Windsor, an 83-year-old woman who got a hefty estate tax bill, which is much larger than that a heterosexual married couple would have to pay. And, of course, she was married just before her partner died. They got married in the state of New York, where same-sex marriage were allowed. But because taxes are federal, she got nailed. And that's she's seeking justice from the courts. My sense is, Tobias, there's actually a piece in Wednesday's New York Times by Maureen Dowd where she makes the argument that in both Prop 8 and DOMA, she expects this court to kind of kick the can down the road, to basically take the narrowest rulings and not to rule boldly. And she points out rather cynically that, of course, this is a court that's perfectly capable of being bold when it comes to Bush v. Gore or Citizens United, where they opened the floodgates for unlimited and unattributed money in our political system. So do you share that cynicism that this is going to basically, the can's going to be kicked down the road?
Well, I don't share a cynical view of these cases. I think that in the Prop 8 case, there are some legitimate and genuinely serious questions about whether this case is properly before the Supreme Court. And in order to issue a ruling on the merits of this case in Prop 8, the court would actually need to make some law about how lawsuits get appealed and how lawsuits get brought in front of the Supreme Court. And I won't go into detail about that, but suffice it to say that as a procedure scholar, I care a lot about those issues. And I don't think it's cynical at all to say that the court needs to give them some very serious attention. In the case of the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, There was argument today on another technical issue, which the court asked the parties to address, about whether the fact that the Obama administration has ceased defending the constitutionality of DOMA means that there's some kind of problem with the case coming up to the Supreme Court. I would be very, very surprised if that kind of technical issue wound up carrying the day in the federal DOMA case. I think that the court is going to issue a ruling on the merits in this case. And so I guess then the question is, what are they going to say? Now, it's very dangerous to predict outcomes in Supreme Court cases, but if the court were to rule in Edie Windsor's favor and either say that DOMA was unconstitutional as applied to her, or to say more broadly that DOMA is unconstitutional when it's applied to legally married gay couples, that would be a big ruling. And, it remains to be seen whether that happens and how broadly the court writes in its ruling. But I think that, with all respect to Maureen Dowd, I don't share her cynicism. What I expect is a serious grappling with these technical issues in the Prop 8 case, and I expect a decision on the merits in the DOMA case, whichever way it goes.
So a serious grappling with the technical issues in the Prop 8 case would basically take us back to Judge Vaughn Walker's ruling.
Well, that's a possibility. I wish I could make this sound simple, but it's tough to do. One bottom line possibility is a ruling that would basically make Judge Walker's district court ruling the last word. And if that happens, then there's going to be a little bit more work to do in figuring out exactly what that means for gay and lesbian couples in California, other than the ones who were actually the parties in the lawsuit. Another possibility, if the court decides to simply dismiss the appeal to the Supreme Court, if it sort of changes its mind, as it were, and decides to just get rid of the appeal, which is one of the possibilities that Justice Kennedy raised during argument yesterday, if that were to happen, then barring any surprises, probably the Ninth Circuit's ruling would be the last word. And if the Ninth Circuit's ruling wound up being the last word, then that would mean that Prop 8 is unconstitutional for everybody in California, at least for now. There would be a little bit more work to do in down the road in making sure that stuck. But there's the possibility of further chapters in the story in California. People have been grappling with this issue for such a long time in California that I know they just want a clean resolution. But one way to get a clean resolution in California would be for Prop 8 to be repealed. And that's still a possibility. But short of that, there may be more work to do.
Well, the polls would indicate that that's a possibility since they've shifted so dramatically since 2008.
Yeah, I think that's right. I saw Attorney General Kamala Harris on a news program the other day, and she cited a figure which I had not seen, but I'm sure it's correct, that 61% of the population in California would like to see Prop 8 go. And that is a dramatic shift, and if it's pretty close to accurate, then that might be a good avenue.
So, Tobias Wolff, since you have done work on cases involving discrimination by the Boy Scouts of America, as well as a number of gay rights cases, one of the things I find extraordinary here is that the Mormon Church was largely behind Proposition 8. The Mormon Church is largely behind the anti-gay discrimination in the Boy Scouts because they're a dominant member of the Boy Scouts of America. And even though some of the very high-profile corporate heads are on the board are urging that the Boy Scouts of America catch up to the 21st century or even the 20th century, the resistance is coming from the Mormon Church. And, of course, the Mormon Church overturned or prevented the ERA, Equal Rights Amendment, from becoming law. So do you see, I know Mitt Romney didn't get elected, but what is going on here in terms of this small but powerful lobby?
Well, I'll just mention the work that I've done in relation to the Boy Scouts. I've not been involved in any of the litigation. I've written about the Supreme Court decision in that famous case, the James Dale versus Boy Scouts case. And I'm not sure that it's fair to single out the Mormon Church quite so dramatically. There's been a lot written, and appropriately so, about the role of the Mormon Church in California's fight over Prop 8. But, I mean, maybe there's information I'm not aware of, but I wouldn't have identified the Mormon Church as such a central figure in some of the other fights that you identified. But, you know, more broadly, I think that there is a national conversation underway, and it's a conversation that includes strands of law and constitutional principle. It includes political development. You see major shifts in the endorsement by Democratic politicians in the last couple of weeks, even for marriage equality and repeal of DOMA in the ramp up to the cases in the Supreme Court today. And there are major discussions going on in churches of all denominations. And that is a necessary process. You know, this kind of civil rights issue is never a simple matter of, you know, one bold pronouncement and then we can put it all behind us. There's plenty of people in the public square who I disagree with. There's plenty of people in the public square that I agree with. But, this is the conversation that we need to be having in order for this shift in the citizenship status of gay and lesbian people to be a really lasting one.
But in terms of religious conservatives and their influence over this issue of gay marriage or marriage equality, what was striking in today's hearings before the Supreme Court, Tobias Wolff, was when Justice Elena Kagan told the courtroom and quoted actually from the official House of Representatives transcript of 17 years ago when legislators said that one of the main reasons to pass DOMA was to express moral disapproval over gays and lesbians being allowed to wed. And that provoked, gasps from the audience.
It was a very dramatic moment. I was not in the courtroom, but I listened to the recording, and you indeed can hear the gasps when Justice Kagan read that language. It is important to point out that moral disapproval of the type that was expressed in that House report is not the exclusive province of religious conservatives or any other group. These are struggles that we have to have across the board to engage with people and to really, show people who aren't yet convinced that gay and lesbian brothers and sisters have the same qualities of humanity as any other member of the American community. And, I think that there are major shifts underway in religious communities, including conservative religious communities, around this issue. There are major conversations going on in denominations around the country about what their views ought to be on this issue, but also how much of a priority it ought to be in their public advocacy. And the fact that Justice Kagan's recitation of that House report provoked gasps is, I think, some indication of a change in sensibility.
Well, just in closing, Tobias Wolff, just back to the to reading the tea leaves here, or handicapping what's going to become the ruling that will come down in June. What's your sense, though? Back to that question about whether it'll be narrow and undramatic, or whether it could be what so many people that are demonstrating in front of the Supreme Court are hoping for, which is that same-sex marriage in this country will become legal. So obviously, between those two possibilities, the ruling is likely to come down. But given that, as you've just pointed out, the times have changed, etc., just based upon the demonstrations taking place in front of the Supreme Court with the pro and con, there is the possibility, of course, of a social backlash, which, in fact, Judge Vaughn Walker warned Theodore Olson about in the original ruling. So how do you think it's going to come down?
Well, I will say this. With the caveat that predicting these things is a perilous endeavor, there were very few indications in the argument for the Prop 8 case that the court was interested in issuing a sweeping, broad ruling. That certainly doesn't make it impossible, but listening to the justices and the questions they were asking and what it sounded like they were genuinely grappling with, there were very few, if any, indications that this was a court that was eager or perhaps even ready to issue a really sweeping ruling. In the DOMA case that was argued today, there was certainly a lot of skepticism on the court, partly about the equal protection concerns, partly about the federalism questions. It was interesting that really no one arguing before the court today, particularly Paul Clement, the former Solicitor General, who was arguing in defense of DOMA, no one was really making arguments about why straight couples' marriages are better than gay couples' marriages. The arguments in favor of DOMA were really sort of very sanitized, I guess, arguments about we want to take things slowly and we want to have a uniform policy before the federal government, arguments like that. And that says something when the arguments in favor of the statute seem a little bit soft in their language, if you know what I mean. So maybe that gives some indication of the direction the court is leaning in the DOMA case. But in the Prop 8 case, I would be very surprised if they issue a broad ruling.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Tobias Wolff.
Thank you for having me on, Ian. I appreciate it.
Again, I've been speaking with Tobias Wolff, who's a professor at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. His research includes the fields of civil procedure and constitutional law, and his advocacy work has included participation in some of the highest-profile gay rights cases of the last several years. He is one of the nation's leading authorities on the U.S. military's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy, and has written on discrimination by the Boy Scouts of America and has commented widely on marriage equality. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the very real possibility that there'll be a war or some kind of military action between North and South Korea.
No one you can save that can't be saved. Nothing you can do, but you can learn how to be you in time. It's easy.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Sumi Terry, the Senior Research Scholar at the Weatherhead East Asia Institute at Columbia University and the Managing Director at Gerson Global Advisors. Previously, she was a National Intelligence Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, the former Deputy National Intelligence Officer for East Asia at the National Intelligence Council, and the Director of Japan, Korea, and Oceanic Affairs at the National Security Council. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sumi Terry.
Thank you.
And do you think that the young leader, Kim Jong-un, and the propaganda machine in North Korea is sort of digging a hole, a rhetorical hole, if you will, for the North, in as much as their rhetoric has gotten so bellicose, where they're threatening the United States, Guam, South Korea? They just cut off the hotline between North and South Korea. They've talked about demanding that the islands that they shelled the last time get evacuated, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, at what point does Kim Jong-un have to deliver to his own people on his rhetoric?
So that is my concern. He has to deliver now. And if you look at his North Korea's past record, when they talk like this, this much of a rhetoric, they always delivered. So that is my concern, although I do not think that Kim Jong-un, unlike maybe Dennis Rodman is, but Kim Jong-un is not suicidal, and I don't think that he's looking to really escalate to the point of no return. He knows that general war means the end of his regime. But the concern is, because he will have to follow through with some sort of provocative action, such as maybe another nuclear test, or some sort of limited and controlled and calculated attack, such as Chang'an or Yeongpyeong Island shelling that happened in 2010, I believe. But the problem is that this time, South Korea has to respond. South Korea is not the same anymore. You know, even though they didn't really respond to Chang'an, in the aftermath of Yeongpyeong Island attack in 2010, it has to respond. So my concern is there's always that potential for things to escalate beyond what either North Korea or South Korea intends or want to do.
Well, obviously, the disparity here is the fact that the South has so much more to lose than the North, in the sense that it's a modern industrial society and Seoul is within artillery distance of the DMZ, and North Korea is a kind of time warp kind of society with lots of tunnels and paranoia and war preparation around the clock. That's not to suggest that there's any difference between the lives of North Koreans and South Koreans, but what makes you think that the South has to retaliate? Is it to do with the new leader in the South? Because when I talk to a lot of specialists on South Korea and on the Korean Peninsula, they tell me that in South Korea itself, there's a big constituency that doesn't believe its own government and is not entirely unsympathetic to the North.
That is absolutely right. I mean, you're right in so many, all of your points. South Korea has a lot more to lose. And South Korean public, there's a lot of people that's more empathetic to North Korea. But the problem is, so South Korea has never responded. Not really. Remember when North Koreans blew up South Korean civilian airliner, killing hundreds of people? When North Korea blew up half of South Korean cabinet in Burma, in Rangoon? All these actions, South Korea did not really respond. And that's what North Koreans are banking on. However, in the aftermath of the Yeongpyeong Island shelling in 2010, which unfolded in front of all the people's eyes, public's eyes, because it unfolded in the television, unlike the Chang'an incident,
the warship,
there has to be some sort of response, that it has shifted, that you cannot just continually not respond in any kind of way. Now, Park Geun-hye, the President Park, and South Korean public knows that they don't want to really escalate. So they are also going to do something that's also limited and controlled, eye to eye, so not to really provoke North Korea. So in the end, if you ask me which way I'm going to bet that North Korea is going to do something limited and controlled and calculated, and so is South Korea, and then everyone's going to try to get back to talks, and things will be fine. But still, you cannot bank on that, because then you still can't ignore that possibility something could still escalate out of what people want to do or intend to do. So that is my concern.
What about the warship, the Chun'an, is the warship that was torpedoed, the assumption
right.
is. Now, what about the nuclear element? Has that changed the equation? Is the South in any way deterred the idea that the North may have a deliverable nuclear weapon?
No, is South Korea deterred by deliverable? No, it's because conventional weapons, it's not that North Korea is going to really ever use nuclear weapons against South Korea. I don't think South Korean public believes that. And if North Korea really intended to do so, it could attack South Korea by conventional attack, and it could really hurt South Korean. I mean, it's just a very small country. Both North and South Koreas are very, very small. So it could do a similar kind of damage with just conventional weapons alone. It's just that, as you said earlier, South Korea has a lot to lose, so they don't want to escalate. But they also have gotten to the point where they feel like it's doing nothing. You have to still respond in some way. And Park Geun-hye, President Park, promises she will respond. Now, again, I'm sure the Blue House is meeting right now, going over all possible scenarios, and we'll try to do something very limited and symbolic. And most likely, things will turn out okay. I don't think it will lead to a general war. However, there is still that possibility. So I'm just not discounting the possibility that things could escalate out of control.
Again, I'm speaking with Sumi Terry, who's a senior research scholar at the Weatherhead East Asia Institute at Columbia University and the managing director of Gerson Global Advisors. Previously, she was a national intelligence fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and the former deputy national intelligence officer for East Asia at the National Intelligence Council and the director of Japan, Korea, and Oceanic Affairs at the National Security Council. So, from what you're telling us, Sumi Terry, in the ideal world, or almost in a kind of movie fantasy world, the North and the South could meet together in secret and agree upon what kind of kabuki theater war they could have. You know?
And then
we could all sort of breathe a sigh of relief. But the problem is that the North, even if it's going to do something limited to realize its threats, to make good on its threats, and that the South is going to do something because they feel they have to do something, we don't know what this will be, and it's very hard to fight limited wars.
That's exactly right, and you put it very, very nicely. But this is why I think most Korea watchers tend to now agree. If you have to choose between the two incidents of Cheonan, where they sank the South Korean ship, and Yeongpyeong incident, they will do something more stealthy and sneaky like Cheonan attack, meaning that it took a while for the international community to figure out that it was really North Korea. So when North Koreans do something like this, stealthy naval attack, for example, and it takes more time for the world to find out that it was North Korea, then this creates a built-in sort of cooling off period, right? They will work towards North Korea's advantage. And it lessens the chance of a disproportionately large strike or response by South Korea. So I think they're going to be creative and come up with something like this. So I thought initially when we heard about the cyber attack and so on in South Korea, I thought, oh, maybe that's a potential possibility. But they will do something. We just don't know exactly what.
Well, there was, of course, a picture released by North Korea's propaganda ministry of Kim Jong-un inspecting military drills along with the Korean People's Army. There were Navy officers standing next to him. So, I mean, obviously,
right.
That's not evidence, but...
No, but it definitely shows something. Now, I just wanted to comment, as for timing, it took the North about 4 months to make good on its promise to avenge the 2009 naval skirmish with South, which then led to this Cheonan attack in 2010. So, you know, it's not that they're also going to respond right away. They could buy some time as well. So we don't know exactly. It is coming, but we don't know exactly what or when. But I do feel like they have to make good on their threat and do something.
So the fact that we're having this conversation, Sumi Terry, about we both agree that something's going to happen between the North and the South. So surely the Chinese know this too. So what kind of dialogue's going on between the Chinese and the North Koreans? If China is good to its word, where it wants to de-escalate tensions on the peninsula, not escalate them.
Right. No, and I'm sure China is trying to talk to the North Koreans as well as there. I know that Xi Jinping just spoke to South Korean president. I'm sure Xi Jinping also spoke to President Obama. We're all talking to China. Now, China's response is kind of interesting because there were some intriguing signs that China was sort of being helpful and they were backing away from this, you know, don't ever criticize North Korea thing, and they were on board with a UN Security Council resolution, and they criticized North Korea and so on. But we just don't know, you know, how strongly they plan to implement the sanctions and really squeeze North Korea. Now, if something happens between North and South in terms of any kind of attack, China will blame South Korea and us, United States, for, you know, it's because you guys were, you know, joint exercises that we are engaged in right now, that we provoke North Korea and so on. But I'm sure they are trying to de-escalate the situation and trying to talk to North Koreans. The question is Kim Jong-un listening? Because Kim Jong-un did not listen, and he did follow through with a missile test and another nuclear test just recently.
So what will this do then, assuming an incident takes place either soon or, as you say, there were 4 months between the last time that North Korea felt it was provoked and when it struck at the South. What does this do, though, for President Obama's policy of strategic patience with North Korea?
Well, you know, I don't think President Obama has too many options here. I think he will just sort of stick with this until things calm down, because it's not like he can now go back to the North Koreans in the midst of all this and say, yes, let's get back to talks. It's just not going to happen. So everything has to calm down for a certain period of time. There has to be some sort of peace and no heightening of tensions for us to even consider it. You know, I know President Obama has been criticized for the policy, for having sort of a non-policy. Some people criticize strategic patience as a non-policy. But it is a policy, both President Clinton and President Bush, at least in the second term, had a turnaround policy. President Bush started as more of a hardliner, but his policy really changed in the second term and engaged with North Korea and held talks with North Korea. But that didn't really got us much either. I think President Obama's policy is not going to change all that much. He just has to sort of stick with this for now. As you know, and you've heard this many times before by Korea watchers, North Korea is just a land of bad options. There's just no good option when it comes to North Korea. But I think for now, he will just have to stick with this strategic patience policy.
Well, just in closing then, Sumi Terry, the pattern is pretty clear that the North behaves like a delinquent child, and nobody can really punish the North because they've had sanctions forever, and it's still, the regime still stays in place, and they're isolated more than ever, and they still, the regime still stays in place. And they basically have created a dynamic where they get rewarded for bad behavior. So do you foresee this dynamic ever changing, or will it require everybody just having to swallow their pride and recognize the regime?
This dynamic, unfortunately, has been in place for the last couple of decades. It will stay in place until we make a drastic decision and do something. Either engage North Korea, as you said, swallow our pride, go back and really talk to them, and this, or you know, more of a kinetic action. But it's otherwise, until you make this very difficult choice, and neither option is a good option, obviously. You know, but unless you go, we choose one, you know, to follow, choose this, follow one path, I'm afraid this is sort of going to be the pattern. It has been the pattern, and it will continue to be a pattern. Well, something has to drastically change, and it's not going to be North Korea. It has to be a decision made by Washington and South Korea.
Well, Sumi Terry, I thank you so much for joining us.
Sure. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Sumi Terry, who's a senior research scholar at the Weatherhead East Asia Institute at Columbia University and the managing director at Gerson Global Advisors. Previously, she was a national intelligence fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, the former deputy national intelligence officer for East Asia at the National Intelligence Council, and the director of Japan, Korea, and Oceanic Affairs at the National Security Council. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the rentier capitalism, as our next guest describes modern American capitalism.
Well, I feel just like a child. Yeah, I feel just like a child. Well, I feel just like a child. Well, I feel just like a child. From my womb to my tomb, I guess I'll always be a child.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Michael Lind, who's the co-founder of the New America Foundation and policy director of New America's Economic Growth Program. His books include The Radical Center, The Future of American Politics, and Made in Texas, George W. Bush and the Southern Takeover of American Politics, The American Way of Strategy, and What Lincoln Believed. His latest book is Land of Promise, An Economic History of the United States. And Michael Lind has a three-part series of articles at Salon.com, Private Sector Parasites, How Rich Mooches Hurt America, and Defeating Useless Rich People. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Lind.
Thank you.
And your articles at Salon.com, of course, they have very provocative titles, but it would seem to me that the American people need to wake up to the reality of what American capitalism has become. You describe it as a kind of rentier capitalism. So explain the difference between rents and profits.
Well, economists used to distinguish between rents, which are extracted from society by people who control valuable resources, which could be natural resources. It could be creditors with privileged rights to create money, and profits, which are earned by businesses, you know, by selling goods and services that people want. So if you are the owner of a toll bridge and every time someone passes, you have to pay a toll, and you're just earning this money for no effort whatsoever, it's completely passive activity, then you're a classic of rentier or rentier, as they say in France. If you are in the business of, let's say, making new tablets and selling them to people who want this new appliance, and your income comes from the results of this innovation, then you're a classic capitalist. What I argue in my Salon series is that a lot of economists and many conservatives and libertarians have forgotten the distinction between rentiers, these purely passive money extractors, and actual entrepreneurs and business executives, and the business workers, too, who are adding something to society. And I go beyond that and argue that to really understand the economy, there are indeed takers and makers. There are productive people and unproductive people. But the takers are not all in the private sector, or all in the public sector, and the makers are not all in the private sector. You can't have a flourishing modern industrial economy without a good school system, without an infrastructure system, without good governance. So that's an essential part of the productive economy in the public sector. At the same time, all private money-making activities are not productive. They don't necessarily add to the long-term capability of the economy to produce goods and services using technology at a lower price.
Well, I thought, for example, the toll booth owner was the person who built the road and therefore was entitled to pay for it through tolls. But, I mean, aren't there better examples like hedge fund managers who basically handle the money of wealthy people and essentially make money for themselves and make money for wealthy people?
Well, and also a lot of there's the other distinction that needs to be made besides that between rents and profits is between real serious investments in productive enterprises and speculation in assets. So if I'm rich and I invest in a breakthrough new technology that transforms the world for the better, you know, that's what capitalism does well. If I use the same amount of money and invest it because I want to corner the world market for Picasso paintings and then sell them at a premium, that has done nothing, you know, to increase the productivity of the actual economy of goods and services. It's just pure speculation.
And nothing's more, I think, a more graphic example of pure speculation is these microsecond trades that go on and these high-speed computer trades that go on Wall Street, which a lot of the hedge funds are behind, where they just literally churn over billions of stocks for milliseconds and make tiny fractions of profits, but it all adds up.
Yeah, they're leveraging currencies or, in some cases, imperfections in the stock market that ordinary investors can't detect, and it really serves no useful function in terms of long-term, patient, steady investment in productivity-enhancing enterprises, which is why a lot of economists, including the late James Tobin of Yale, have proposed taxing it as just a form of unproductive gambling. He proposed a Tobin tax, a small financial transactions tax that could generate a lot of money for governments. At the same time, it's a kind of a sin tax. And sin taxes actually are so-called sin taxes. Are the traditional response of governments to unproductive activities. You're not going to outlaw them. At least you can tax them and raise revenue from them. What a lot of governments do as well is to prevent the rentiers from making excessive amounts of money at the expense of the rest of the economy is to have very high taxes on rents, in some cases property taxes. A lot of countries, including Australia and Canada, have super profits taxes or resource taxes on natural resources on the theory that the mere fact that there's a rare earth mine on your property, really you've done nothing to justify having a vast fortune as a result of that compared to a real entrepreneur. It's just an accident of of land title. And in the case of Canada, the taxes from the resource extraction in some cases are redistributed among all the provinces on the theory that it's unfair that a single province or state should have the benefits of this geographic accident.
Again, I'm speaking with Michael Lind, who's the co-founder of the New America Foundation and author of Land of Promise, an Economic History of the United States, and he has a three-part series of articles at Salon.com, Private Sector Parasites, How Rich Mooches Hurt America, and Defeating Useless Rich People. So, obviously, it's become culturally acceptable. The new definition of capitalist, as you point out in your article, it's not about the productive entrepreneur or the successful industrialist, but anybody who makes money nowadays. And this has led to these people like these payday lenders and this for-profit college racket. In both of those cases, it's the federal government that allows these parasites to make money because they make campaigns to politicians. And it really gets down to our campaign finance system, where they can simply bribe enough congresspeople to steal people blind. And in the case of the education racket with these for-profit colleges, that's all federal money that they're making money on.
Well, that's right. And if you look at federal, state, and local levels, the traditional argument for having public education, including public universities and colleges, was that this was kind of a natural monopoly or oligopoly, and just like sewage and water and electricity, and you wanted to provide it to your citizens at cost without needing to pay shareholders super profits or, you know, enormous bonuses and benefits to the managers. What we see now with this trend towards privatization and the replacement of social insurance with, private for-profit plans, you know, like Paul Ryan's plan for voucherizing Medicare, that's the worst of all worlds, because you would pressure, or in some cases through individual mandates, compel people to buy these private substitutes for former public programs. But at the same time, these would be profit-making enterprises. And so you would you'd be forcing your citizens to pay for the salaries and the compensation of very well-remunerated executives and shareholders.
Well, this is, I think, again, because of the power of money, and because we have a political campaign system based upon money, so he who has the most money controls the most politics in this country. And so that's led to the oligarchs essentially taking over and writing laws, and they have their faithful servants in the Congress, and they've created a system for themselves where they privatize their gains while they socialize their losses.
Well, I think progressives really need to make this distinction as well, because what I'm arguing is not simply the usual line that there are special interests exploiting the public. There are good special interests and bad special interests. Now, it may very well be that farmers and miners and manufacturers rig laws in their favor to have, you know, good depreciation allowances or a subsidy here or there. But if at the end of the day they are creating a more productive economy and everybody's benefiting from it, you know, you can forgive a certain amount of subsidy. If it's a purely wasteful activity, like replacing Social Security with for-profit annuities and forcing hundreds of millions of seniors just to pay management fees to money managers on Wall Street, then, you know, there's no benefit to the economy from that at all. It's a net loss, except to the individuals who profit from this what's called rent-seeking activity. So the point is not that that government is good or business is bad or vice versa, that there are rent-extracting elements in both the private and the public sector, just as there are productive elements on both sides.
So, Michael Lind, obviously, to redefine or at least define our current form of capitalism accurately and make the distinction between finance capitalism, rentier capitalism, and industrial capitalism, which is what we used to have and what we still think of in large part, even though the extractive types have basically taken over, and Wall Street is, of course, the poster boy of extractive capitalism, and Mitt Romney was the poster boy of their perfect representative. So at least we can breathe a sigh of relief that he didn't become president. But what can be done then, apart from the first stage, meaning the wake-up call, which is what your articles at Salon.com are providing? But you're basically saying this: it's going to require a populist campaign, right, to force this unproductive form of capitalism to basically take away its privileges.
Yeah, I think that's right. And you know, maybe it would need a coalition of progressives and some Main Street conservatives, and it would cut across party lines to some extent. I got pushback by including higher education in the rent-extracting unproductive sector. Because a lot of progressives have very idealized utopian view of the higher education system. In fact, it's become arguably parasitic. That's not to say there aren't good professors and great schools. But if you look at the last generation, the costs have just exploded way out of proportion to increases in economic growth. The tuition has exploded. 50% of undergraduates now are taught by non-tenured lecturers and adjuncts, who make slightly above poverty level wages. You know, some of them make $14,000, $15,000, $16,000 a year. So that system is clearly broken. The medical system in the United States, in addition to the actual valuable medical services that are provided, there's also just pure extraction by monopolistic pharma companies. By, frankly, a lot of overpaid specialty physicians, not so much the general practitioners, and by hospitals. And we just know this to be the case because if you compare the U.S. to very similar societies, including Canada and Western Europe, the same things, the same items, like aspirin and doctor's visits and hospitals and appendectomies, cost twice as much in the U.S.
Or much more, actually.
Or more than twice as much, yeah. So that's just pure waste. And usually the argument for making the economy more efficient takes the form of conservative arguments for attacking middle-class entitlements and slashing wages and destroying unions. I think you can have a progressive or even progressive-slash-centrist efficiency agenda where you squeeze out a lot of the private sector waste. And, well, and of course, you should go after public sector waste, you know, in the Defense Department, for example, where it exists. At the same time,
Michael Lind, I was going to suggest that the place to start, maybe in terms of creating a kind of populist movement here to essentially get rid of this parasitic form of capitalism that's dominating our economy, that the millennial generation might be the place to start. Student loan debt now has passed a $1 trillion mark, second only to household mortgage debt, and these kids are getting ripped off by, you say, as you mentioned, by the public sector and private or universities, as well as, of course, the government-subsidized for-profits, which are outright rackets, where they indenture them for life and give them worthless diplomas.
The poster boy for a rent-extracting parasitic industry is the student loan industry, which got Congress – this was unbelievable when I just learned this recently. But in the last decade, they persuaded Congress to write laws so that student loans cannot be discharged in bankruptcy.
Right.
The whole point of bankruptcy is to free people from debts that they cannot pay.
Right, but if you have this generation that's getting ripped off and indentured and there are no jobs for them, that's a good place to start, isn't it, with mobilizing a movement?
I think so, and I think that the millennial generation, it really hasn't found any leaders. There's a time lag. Even Obama really reflects more the worldview of the 1990s Clinton neoliberals in many ways, rather than the younger generation. The older generation of neoliberals in the 90s and the early 2000s had this you know, win-win view of the future. We were all going to be well-paid knowledge workers, you know, inventing things, and other countries could make things, and you know, you could work on Wall Street, or you could you know, maybe write software programs or something like that.
Right, the great information highway that Al Gore was beckoning us to.
Yeah, and so in the actual real world of the United States, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the majority of jobs being created now are essentially jobs that require only on-the-job training beyond high school, and they tend to be low-paid service jobs, healthcare aides, fast food preparers, and others. If you look at the Bureau of Labor Statistics site, where they talk about jobs of tomorrow, apart from registered nurses and teachers, there are no college-educated professional jobs being created in the list of the most numerous jobs at all. And so, you know, I think to that kind of progressivism, this sort of feel-good, happy-talk progressivism where everyone's going to go to college and then, you know, get this very well-paying professional job, that's been discredited by events just as much as the right-wing ownership society in which the janitors, you know, don't need higher wages because they're just going to be counting their returns from their stock market investments.
So just in closing, Michael Lind, what do you think are the chances of a real dialogue, because you're trying to start a debate here with your articles at Salon.com, amongst the economists and the policymakers and the pundits. Do you have any sense that people are really interested in really looking deeper at the very nature of our capitalism? I mean, we've got.
Well, I think so. The response to this particular series of articles in Salon was very encouraging. I got more response to that than anything I'd written in a long time. And I'm not the only one who's talking about this. If you look at writers like Mike Konzel and various others, the economist Michael Hudson, there's even this term rentier, which is kind of an obscure, antiquated term that most people don't understand, somebody who just lives on rents or passive investment. This is gradually bubbling up in discourse. Now, there's a time lag. It sort of works. It begins in the intellectual community, and then filters into journalism, and then into broader public discussion. But I think that there's certainly an audience waiting for a story of what has gone on with the economy, other than the New Democrat story that we just need to deregulate everything and send more people to universities, and the right stories, which is just that we should privatize entitlements and cut taxes on the rich. I don't think either of those are going to win assent, particularly from this younger generation you're talking about.
Well, Michael Lind, I thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Michael Lind, who's the co-founder of the New America Foundation and policy director of New America's Economic Growth Program. His books include The Radical Center, The Future of American Politics, and Made in Texas, George W. Bush and the Southern Takeover of American Politics, The American Way of Strategy, and What Lincoln Believed. His latest book is Land of Promise, An Economic History of the United States. And Michael Lind has a three-part series of articles at Salon.com, Private Sector Parasites, How Rich Moochers Hurt America, and Defeating Useless Rich People. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Bye.